CliffCentral.com.
Hello, lovely people, and welcome to the Mate Sessions with CliffCentral.com. It's been a while, but it was worth the wait because I think we've got a very interesting and exciting show.
Final show
for the year. yeah, but I think it's going to be a good one. I've been dying to do it for a long time.
So have I.
Yes, and you'll find out why. So today we start to explore how the architecture in our homes can affect domestic workers. I used to think that architecture was a specialist field. But through Tuliza, I've realized more and more how space has social, economic, and psychological properties too. Physical space not only facilitates human life as we know it, but it has a profound impact on our headspace. South Africa's history, in particular, is a prime example of how space can be used to segregate, to oppress, to exploit, and to monopolize power. This was the architecture of apartheid. This phenomena can also apply on a micro level, though, and in our very own homes. So here to school us a little bit is Mate Sessions co-host and architect extraordinaire, Tuliza Cindy. Hi, lovely. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
Good, thank you. Have you got your expert hat on?
I'm so nervous.
Why?
Because I'm not even remotely close
yeah,
to an expert.
Yeah, right. She's just trying to manage
expectations. Feel my way through this industry, you know?
No, lies. It's a strategy. She's trying to set expectations low, but she knows she's got this. Okay, so true to your very sophisticated nature, we've broken the conversation up into the following themes. Territory, association, control, access, ownership, and autonomy. Now, I don't know what the hell those things mean, but pray do tell us first and foremost about territory.
Okay, so let me start. Before I get to territory, let me just start with where my premise comes from.
Okay.
As a spatial practitioner, which
is... Of course, premise. Of course. I forgot the premise. Do you tell us your premise and hypothesis?
Absolutely. I will do that. So space is inherently psychological and mental before it is physical, right? It has to be conceived.
Right.
Before it can be made.
Exactly.
Before it can go on paper.
Uh-huh.
So... And it's never conceived without intent, right? There's always a reason why someone wants space.
Mm.
Someone wants a building. Someone wants urbanity.
Essentially, actually, my introduction wasn't that good because what I was saying is space has those implications, psychological, social, economic.
But actually, it is those
but
things.
But it actually is those things. It's born from those things.
Yeah. So it is those things before it is physical.
Of course.
Yes. And that is why that's been my focus in my career, is to understand psychological space making rather than physical space making. Because I think there's more than enough people that make physical space.
Right.
So inherently, space is never neutral. And we've seen how it can be conceived for purely functional purposes, which is what it essentially started as. Eventually, it became monumental, social, political. So it started to cross these different territories, and you know, it started to represent different things. Now space can be indulgent when before it was purely functional. So ultimately, even though we use space as individuals, you know, that we have complete, or for the most part, we have autonomy within space as individuals, we're still working on someone's inherent canvas, right? Someone decided that that space has to be a certain way.
Right.
And we're using that space on those terms.
Right.
And then things are getting born out of that.
So that's incredible in the sense that, you know, you go into a space, say you buy a house, right? You go into that space with the intention to make it your own and to define it.
Yeah.
But you never think about how it can define you.
Yes. Because you're always starting from somewhere. It's never neutral. And like a prime example of it is something like apartheid spatial planning, where maybe our intent as a country was supposed to be, you know, a better relationship between different cultural groups and that sort of stuff. But the spatial planning, because it existed programmed to...
Girl, was that really the end of better relations?
You know, let's just...
Or is that how they...
Let's assume.
Okay.
Let's assume that in an ideal series of events...
That their bullshit is what was supposed
to happen, right? Architecture. The architecture has still managed to keep what its inherent intent was, which was to divide. Mm. And so that's why we see, even with our transport systems and that kind of stuff, that there still hasn't been able to be a significant closing of the gap, right? Mm. Between what was literally physically divides that were created. Mm. So that is, I think, hopefully this a tangible thing as a country that we can make sense of
in terms of
what a space is and what we inherit spatially. So one of my favorite philosophers and sociologists who theorized a lot on space, he divided space into three components. Mm. So the one was conceived space, that the next lived space, and the last perceived space. That space is always all of those three things.
Okay. So go again.
So the first being conceived space, mm-hmm. which is simply the space that we think, right? Mm. The space that we imagine. Mm. It's also representations of space. So it's the way that we think and what we put down on paper as a representation of what we think. Mm. So that's conceived space. Then we have lived space, which is the way we approach space mentally. Mm. And we have perceived spaces, which is the way we approach space through feeling.
Wow.
And so all of those things.
And for all of us who thought those three words meant the same thing.
Girl, I did too. Okay, I did too. And so with that, that is where the six different topics come from.
Okay.
But when we think of something and we think of it on spatial terms, we always fill it with something.
Okay.
So you can never imagine space without thinking it on your own terms.
Okay. And it always has inherent properties.
Yeah.
Even if it's empty or looks empty.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. You can still pin it down. You can still talk to a typology or, you know, but you can always refer to it as something.
Okay.
Because, you know, if it was void of anything, which it never is.
Right. So there is no such thing as empty space.
In my opinion.
In your opinion.
Yeah. It's not necessarily that the architecture industry.
No, I think you make a good argument. That's I agree.
Yeah. And so, and design, I think sometimes can be confused between something that must look good versus something that fulfills its inherent purpose, which for me is what design is about, is if it can fulfill its inherent purpose.
Okay.
And I mean, it's also associated to problem solving, but also visionary thinking.
Okay.
That you have to imagine even before your client knows what they want, that you sometimes give them what they didn't even realize they need.
So let's talk about territory as opposed to space. Territory speaks to appropriation, right?
Mm, it does. And what we can find, I think...
Or like... ownership.
Yes. And what I think is quite prevalent, which I think a lot of us have seen, is how domestic workers often crowd at the corners of suburbs, you know, just on the lawn. And what's very interesting is that in a way they're always within the suburban territory, right? So they've never left. But it speaks to the degrees of freedom that they feel. So in certain spaces, they feel more free than certain other spaces. Mm. So often the domestic workers that we've spoken to have told us how they're not allowed to bring friends over. Mm. Or sometimes if they want to speak to their friend, they have to speak over the gate and really quickly. Mm. And their movements are monitored, or their time is always quite regulated. Mm. And so sometimes privacy doesn't even exist in the only place within the home that is private.
Right.
And so there's such an irony to that part of the street sometimes feeling more private than an actual private space.
An incredible irony. How does that happen? And it's not just the street corner. I mean, it's parks as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You'll often find domestic workers and other workers kind of the working class, if you will, you know, builders, waitresses, cashiers, kind of, and usually black, having their meals. You know, I have a shopping center across from my house, and then I'm in a suburb, so I'm also surrounded by different households.
Mm.
And there's a park between me and the shopping center, and the domestic workers go there,
mm.
as well as the builders if there's construction,
yeah.
as well as the cashiers from Woolworths,
yeah.
as well as the waiters from the restaurants.
Mm. Wow.
They all leave their place of work,
mm.
which for kind of, it's ironic for the domestic workers because they work in a home and a lot of the time they live in that home as well. But I feel like it's also ironic for instance, a waiter
mm.
who works in a restaurant
mm.
that serves food
mm.
to go probably not to Woolworths,
yeah.
but to walk quite a distance to a ShopRite or a different cafe to get a certain type of food,
yeah.
and then walk to a park to have a meal,
mm.
only to go back to work to serve food.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But you tell me, Em,
mm.
have you ever felt comfortable in a place where you were watched?
Mm.
And it comes
That's
down to
interesting,
that.
Though, because in a corporate environment,
mm.
employees feel more than comfortable to take their meals in the cafeteria or even at their desk.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I've never thought about it twice.
Well, this actually that you touch on, because you're so good at this.
Sorry.
No, honestly, but it deals with the thing that we're going to later, which is association,
okay.
right? And that has to do with, okay, so if I decide that I will design a lounge for myself,
mm.
and I use it as a lounge, it is a lounge
mm.
for me,
mm.
right? But if you say you were a cleaner, mm. if you use it only to clean, it is not a lounge to you.
Aha. Uh-huh.
You see what uh-huh. I mean?
Uh-huh.
So if the employee, say the corporate person, mm. uses the cafeteria as a cafeteria, uses the kitchen as a kitchen, uses the office space as an office space, the cleaner only ever uses every space as a cleaning space. And so it doesn't necessarily become a kitchen for them or a cafeteria for them. You see
okay.
what I mean?
Okay. That's interesting. And so now let's go back to
the domestic work.
Yes, into territory.
Yes.
What gives you territory over something?
Often, everyone is able to associate certain needs to the spaces that they walk into, right?
Mm.
But when you can also associate wants to those environments, that's mm. when that space changes, right?
Okay.
And your wants speak to your desires or your dreams or comforts.
Okay.
Right?
So which it is goes different. Beyond functionality.
Yes, exactly.
It's just basic survival.
Yeah.
It's all of the it's the bells and the whistles and the frills that make a space, that
yes.
give a space an identity rather than
exactly.
a utility.
Okay. Exactly. And so when you look at a typical domestic worker unit,
mm.
they often have maybe windows that are too high, and it's purely for the inlet of air.
Mm.
Nothing else. It's not necessarily for views.
Mm.
They don't have storage, which means technically you're never comfortable enough there if you can't unpack, if you can't settle
mm.
in,
mm.
you know?
Mm.
And so it's completely stripped down to you only ever being able to use it for the purpose.
So now this thing excites me because it goes back to identity.
Mm, it does.
Right? Which goes back to classism.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
To the reasons why, and for me, regardless of whether there are rules,
mm.
even if a domestic worker works in a home where they are allowed, they technically aren't not allowed to use the dining room table because there was never such a rule,
mm.
right? Even in a restaurant, for instance, where no one's ever said to the waiters, you're not allowed to eat here during lunch.
But can we just discuss the term allowed?
Mm.
Just the fact that there's that possibility that someone might need to allow you
mm.
already speaks to someone else that
mm.
owns
mm.
and you
mm.
that is a visitor.
So that, first of all, but also I think there's a discomfort around spaces we don't perceive to be compatible with us.
Yeah.
And our identity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Spaces we can't identify with. And so somebody might be very accommodating, very welcoming of you in their home, but you might still feel uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
If you can't identify with the way a space is, and which is what you were saying earlier on, about how it's about more than utility, right? It's about essentially the character and the personality that the space takes on, and how the person feels in that space, and whether they feel they can identify. Yeah. And I think on a classist level, you have a lot of people, and look, I think that applies across classes, you know? I think there are working class people who feel uncomfortable in middle class spaces or middle to upper class spaces. And I think there are middle class people who feel uncomfortable in upper class spaces. And I think there's middle class people who feel uncomfortable in lower class spaces. But character is so important.
Yes, but if you, I mean, you spoke to, you know, these, the micro scale of how these things play out. But if you were to, again, bring it to varying scales, because all of these things happen in varying scales, so literally from like city scale to a room in our houses, that's when you have for instance students saying, this university doesn't feel like it's for me, you know, or you'll have an entire city block where, or like you'll have Hillbrow where it mostly attracts foreign Africans, you know, and there's those sorts of reasons. That's associated to class, it's associated to identity, and, you know, something personal that crosses need and function.
So now, I think those are properties that are inherited from the macro environment, right? That come into our homes.
Yes.
That's stuff about our society.
But it's also the micro that creates that macro.
This is the thing that I want to understand. This is my question for you. To what extent is that the society's fault? And to what extent are we to blame?
I think it's gotten to a stage where it's both to blame.
Right.
Because they are just perpetual now.
So how do you think, where territory is concerned, how can we do better in our homes to accommodate our domestic workers?
This, not even on spatial terms, just I think between one human and another, there are certain ways of treatment that is simply not okay. And I understand it's your home and therefore it's your rules, but it touches on the topic of, on the point of ownership, because, you know, sometimes the worker's pay is cut so that, you know, so it's used as rent, but their rules still don't apply. So they don't get to establish rules, and so it's in a way devalues.
So you don't even own the thing you've paid for.
Exactly, completely devalues their money, and again, completely strips you of any sort of autonomy.
And
So even just that on an economic front, that makes no sense, right?
But that's because all this territorial stuff you're talking about overrides ownership.
Yeah, but there is the room for it to be possible.
Yeah. But I think what people are going to find interesting here, and it applies to even when, say you grew up poor, right? And you grew up in the township or in a bad neighborhood, okay? And overnight, you win the lotto or you achieve success.
Yeah.
And you move your family to a leafy suburb, right? And you pay good money for that house, you can still feel alien.
Completely.
You can still never own it.
Yeah, completely. Because it has to be mentally owned.
That is cray cray.
Yeah, it has to be mentally owned, but
that's
before
your cray.
It is physically owned. Yeah, it's true.
That's your cray. Oh my goodness.
So we can live in cities but never feel like a part of the city.
It speaks to how, to a large extent, where we put a focus on economic policies like BEE, we're scratching the surface of the problem. So when it comes to putting such a large emphasis on economic policies like BEE, and doing it in a very capitalistic economic way, where we're literally just dividing the pie, or, you know, we're kind of quantifying, I guess, progress in financial terms. That's not nearly enough.
Absolutely not enough, but definitely not a small problem either. So it's also not a surface wound, unfortunately, because economic freedom is fundamentally crucial, but it must come with many other things. And so
I think, I almost want to say there need to be certain conditions for economic freedom to thrive, right? Or to have an impact, or the desired impact. It has an impact anyway, but the desired impact.
Mm.
But I think there needs to be a kind of a more psychological and a social component built into these kinds of policies.
I think what we inherited was so massive that it feels like, and this is just a gut response, but it feels like we might have split the fight up into different elements. Let's first win this battle.
Mm.
And then with that, let's go for this one. And then with that, let's go for this one. So when we got political power, then the hope was, with this, we can change policies. With this, we can access finances. With this, we can access the judiciary. And then, you know, so it was supposed to, I think, have a ripple effect.
Mm.
But
I don't think you can address the psychological these things. You can put these things in compartments, though.
But I also don't think that was a naive approach.
Yeah.
I really just think the battle was huge.
Yeah.
And I think, to be honest as well, like, a lot of their lives were under threat. A lot of people's lives today are under threat over what they fight for, you know? So sometimes it becomes manageable also when you know what you are capable of fighting for, and that's what you pursue, and someone else will handle another portion, someone else will handle another portion. So it's not necessarily that that is the absolute way to, but I think sometimes when something is completely overwhelming, maybe that starts to make sense.
I love this idea, and I think it's something people need to think about more and more, especially when we live in a very capitalist society, right? And globally.
Mm.
Okay, I think people need to think about the social value that people's money has.
Yes, I don't think that's going to come for a while. Girl. Yes, I mean, we know, but your money's power is overwhelming.
Okay, so basically what we're saying here is that money doesn't necessarily buy you territory.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And a prime example is a domestic worker that will pay for her own space, but will not be allowed to live by her own rules within that space.
So unfortunately, all of the advocates of land reform, unfortunately, all of those fierce activists. And look,
they must continue.
Yeah,
they must
for
continue,
sure.
But I think, but just different forces
definitely
should join in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they need to bear in mind that simply getting the land back might not necessarily be enough. There's a lot more work to do there.
But I think that's why there was a Steve Biko in the movement, because they were not unaware.
Well, that's certainly what we're lacking at the moment, is all of this identity stuff. So we jumped around, but I want to go to association.
So yes, association, as I touched on a bit earlier, has to do with not necessarily using space for what it was intended for.
Mm.
And therefore that space starts to mean different things.
To different people.
Yes. Like a house for a family will mean exactly what that house was meant to be.
Mm.
But for a domestic worker, it means none of that.
So should we be designing in a society where something like domestic work is so prevalent and isn't going anywhere anytime soon, and I suppose that's what the servants' quarters was for in the first place, right?
Yeah.
That was apartheid's way of designing domestic work into homes.
Yeah.
But that was done during apartheid, so it obviously was quite sinister the way they did it and inhumane. But for the modern, contemporary kind of architect, right? In South Africa, do you still recommend we design domestic work into our homes, and how? That's what I'm curious about. What does it look like for you ideally?
Well, the problem isn't spatial in that sense. The problem is human based. And I mean, we've come to see how humans are mostly the glitch in most systems. And in that case, again, it's the human interaction, but it manifests into the way that space is perceived. So it's one of those things that can't quite be controlled with space, because the intent is inherently not exclusive or exclusionary. But then humans make it that way. So in that case, it is...
It's not a spatial intervention per
se. Yeah. But it manifests into a spatial problem. And so when it comes to the ways that people continue to build, that's when it becomes our problem.
But now, do you think that there are things that architects can do better?
Well, I think, okay, so primarily with what they used to call servants' quarters or slave quarters sometimes, they used to do things like have a window 1.8 meters from the ground so that the domestic worker or servant couldn't see through the window and look at the family, right? So that was very, very calculated, or the fact that they didn't have storage space. And those speak to different components, like components that you can put in or take away that create a sense of control within the space. And so just in terms of just like basic human comforts, we can already make a significant difference. But at the end of the day, people will always ruin space. So again, like, we can design incredible systems, and that's been the main flaw in architecture, actually. And that's why there's a constant reimagining of what architecture can and should be, and trying to understand where the limits of architecture are, because we have a limit. Like, there's only so much we can do once we give the building away to people, and then people make things of it, and then we have to reimagine how people use space and reimagine what that means. And that's why people are reimagining what a library means, reimagining what a mall means, because we're constantly finding the way humans use it versus the way we thought they would use it. And we have to reimagine what it inherently means. So,
but would you say, if it is kind of, it does turn into kind of a chicken and an egg situation to some extent. Do you think that we're reimagining and revising spaces fast enough?
Absolutely not. And that's also the other problem with architecture, is it's one of the slowest art forms. And some have argued that 3D technology is helping people imagine spaces much faster. So in a way, you're able to iterate how people would respond to space much faster, because they can imagine it, because it looks real. But it's still not enough, you know, because the moment that space happens, then you've got all these forces that you didn't see coming. So yes, it's a very slow art. It's a slow practice. I mean, a building, sometimes when you conceive it, between when you conceive it and when you finish it, sometimes a quick project can take 3 years. By that time, your conception can be outdated. If you look, for instance, at how fast our political climate is changing, and you have an idea today, by 2020, can you imagine what that'll mean? So yeah, architecture cannot keep up with human progress or regression.
Right. So this is why then the intervention from an architectural point of view needs to be a more psychological one.
Yes.
Because I think architects can teach people how they use space.
Absolutely. And that's actually what I'm trying to explore. Because I'm trying to understand whether we need more buildings. Or because in a lot of instances, we have enough space. And then misuse is what leads to things like abandonment, or, you know, fear leads to abandonment, those sorts of things. But, and that's also personally why I'm conflicted about making more buildings, because I think that we've already got at least more than enough to work with already, in order to then make it about, how we use it, why we use it that way, what we're probably going to do with it. Those sorts of things, which I think are discussions worth having. And I think, you know, even though they're not architecture students or architects, these students are able to just instinctively, and that speaks to perceived space, instinctively know that something was not made for them and it still isn't. Mm. And they're not necessarily completely able to articulate why or how and what must change. Mm. But that feeling remains. And so I think those are definitely worth discussing within the architectural realm, because it's there. The buildings are there. There's only so many buildings we can tear down and start again. And we're probably very likely not going to do it. So we might as well engage with, you know, what those spaces mean, why they mean that.
I think the big problem here is that people don't understand space. The average person hasn't been exposed to that. Even though we're all spatial thinkers, right? We haven't been taught to think spatially. So it kind of it kind of happens by accident, but we don't know how to deliberately kind of manage the relationship that we have with spaces.
Yeah.
And that's where I think it's sad that a discipline like architecture has become so specialist, right? And it's something that I don't remember learning about space in high school, for instance.
Yeah.
So is that something that you would advocate for, some kind of a democratization of architecture, where kind of we give people more people access?
Yeah, that would be so beautiful. But I think we could also get away with not having people make deliberate spatial acts. I think, and for me, again, like where my interest lies, it has to do with exploring just human behavior, right? And maybe associating human behaviors to space. But that essentially it's like we are not we're not an emotionally intelligent society, for instance, right? We're not a financially literate society. So, but those things really, really influence space.
Yeah. So I actually think those might be two different disciplines. I think there's architecture as a craft that you teach to people who want to build buildings.
Yeah.
Right? I think that's one field. And then I think that people haven't been taught what to do with those buildings or how to manage their relationships with those buildings, right? And, so there's, I think...
And it's because we speak about space through programs. Like, this is programmed to be a restaurant.
Exactly. But there's a teaching for the architect and there's a teaching for the user.
Yeah. But the architect must also be trained to understand that. And I mean, part of the struggle as well in our industry is the... You know, the all-encompassing master builder architect who is the visionary who wants to make his object.
But
and
he's also, my understanding from what you're saying is he's also limited.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. But the thing is, I think the architecture industry doesn't quite understand how limited it is. That's also a problem. We also need education.
Exactly. And just to acknowledge that the user, the person who occupies the space, is just as important.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, every time you discuss architecture in this way, they'll say, but that's not really architecture. That's sociology. That's psychology. That's economics. That's what it, but it always gets taken out of the architectural realm.
Would you teach, let's call it the psychology of space. Would you teach that at a high school level? What parts
Absolutely.
Of space would you...
Absolutely.
Build into a high school syllabus. What do you think is most important for people to understand?
I think inherently that space is a thought. I think if we primarily understand that and then understand that thoughts are biased, thoughts are predetermined, thoughts are rooted in desire or in culture or in history, that kind of stuff. And then to further unpack space on those terms, I think I'd be happy.
And space and freedom, right? Certainly could be taught from a historical point of view.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there wasn't enough emphasis in the history syllabus, and I took history, and I loved history, but there wasn't enough emphasis. Look, we always called it the architecture of apartheid, but that was very much a metaphor. We never actually went into how significant spatial planning was.
Yeah.
So I think that definitely can be built into the history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Syllabus, right?
Absolutely. And as an architect, I wasn't taught about architectural. I mean, I wasn't taught about apartheid spatial planning. I wasn't.
No. Surely you did a course on South African history?
I miss you. I wasn't. It was.
Yo.
Let me tell you. Hey, those textbooks. Those textbooks were heavily lacking. I mean, it said ridiculous things like the first vernacular architecture that existed within our country was Victorian architecture.
So as if nothing existed. It's the history of architecture as opposed to the history of our country. And then how does architecture apply?
Yes, but it's a very revised version of history. So again, I don't trust it. And I promise you, I didn't learn apartheid spatial the term and the concept and the actual enacting of apartheid spatial planning in university. I didn't learn it there.
But for me, there's so much of architecture that's a humanities discipline.
But that's also why it's very confused. Like in some institutions, it will be in humanities, and some it's in the sciences, and some it's in the arts.
Uh-huh.
Because it can't really, it doesn't know how to pin itself just yet, because it can exist in all those places.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Let's talk about control. Now, is there a difference between control and territory?
Control is what contributes to the making or the breaking apart of territory.
Oh, okay.
Right? So control deals more with the components, right? It really unpacks it into the different elements that make someone feel free in a certain space, or that makes someone feel watched or limited in another. Mm. And that's really the only difference.
So control is kind of the matrix. So you can, you know what I mean? So you can have territory and not have control. You can feel like you identify with a space and you have territory over it, but not necessarily control.
Absolutely.
How that came to be.
Yes. So control. And that's when you get into the elements.
Okay.
You know, why is it that, again, I pay rent, so it should be my space, and yet I don't feel like I own it.
In many ways, nobody has control in that situation, especially if so much of it has been inherited from the society.
Yeah.
Or from the person who designed the space, or the person who used the space prior to that?
Some architects design spaces so that the user can feel control.
Mm.
Some design it for the purpose of their ego.
I guess you always have limited control. You always have less than you think you do.
Yes, but sometimes, I think it's about feeling enough.
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily full control or, you know, full sense of ownership. It's really just about enough and the space to navigate that as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's what some architects have been able to successfully do, where something doesn't necessarily belong to you, but with time, in the ways that you use it, the ways that you engage with it, the ways that it engages with its context, you start to feel like you own it.
If domestic workers can be intentionally or unintentionally oppressed but by their employers, by their madams.
Mm.
Can madams be intentionally or unintentionally oppressed by the society?
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So can both be victims of a larger oppressive system?
Yeah, varying degrees, but yeah.
But now, how much of this do you think has to do with the mechanization of domestic workers? Because for me, there's a clear objectification here, and you've got to objectify the thing to live with yourself to a large extent, given the way that it is in South Africa, right? It's just a really shit institution.
Alternatively, we also imagine that it could be just to imagine the thing that makes your life convenient as a tool, as the new tool.
Yeah.
The new spear, the new
stone. But that essentially, for me, what that what happens then is that it you become an extension of the home rather than even a human being.
Mm.
Right? You become, they almost, you could put a domestic worker in the bond for a house, the way that people think about it.
Mm.
Right? The same way, maybe you can build like maintenance into your bond.
Mm.
Right? Very certain utilities.
Yeah.
And I think, and this is where I was saying, I always think that the madams are a victim, or us as employees, we're victims of a system.
Or a product of.
Or a product of. Or a product of.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Because I think, well, you know, being a victim is a choice.
Yeah, so, yeah. And it just means that we do still have some form of autonomy.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really all
exactly,
that means. Yeah.
Exactly. So I do prefer a product of. It means essentially when you move into suburbia, right? To keep up with the Joneses, not only are you buying that big house, but you're buying a staff complement, right?
Yeah.
So say maybe the average household on that street has two domestic workers, a security guard and a gardener, right?
Mm.
Before you even move in, those are almost prerequisites. Before you even decide, those types of things can be, you know?
Yeah, because in order to keep up, you're going to need those things.
Exactly. So do you think part of the problem is that we think, do you think domestic workers have become an extension of households rather than
a part of? I think to a large extent, yes.
Yeah.
And then the problem with that is that it has nothing to do with a person, but with the role.
Mm.
That I must have a domestic worker. I must have a gardener. Mm.
So do you think so that's
got nothing to do with
that's what kind of creating an obstacle where the relations are concerned between an employer and domestic worker and the space?
Absolutely. I think definitely to a large extent.
Because maybe they're not thinking about the human factor, as we've often seen.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a huge difference how you share space with what you perceive. And I mean, it's so interesting because, like, I see this on things like buses and trains and things where you have to closely share your public space. But, you know, the ways that people try to find privacy within something that's so public, right? And they do it differently with different characters as well. And I think it's, again, because of all these ways that we just perceive those around us. And then we choose the way that we want to share space with people. So at night, you'd prefer to cross the road because you don't want to be mugged or you don't want to be raped or whatever it is. But you choose the way that person makes you feel and then the way that space plays out.
But you first and foremost need to see that person as a person to have that reaction. So what you say, because for me, it almost feels like the reaction we're having in our households to our domestic workers and sharing that space with them, it almost feels non-reactive, numb. Whereas when you're in a bus, it doesn't matter who you are, when you're in a bus and somebody sits next to you, you react.
Yeah.
You're conscious.
Yeah.
You either choose to share that space in an open manner or to kind of withdraw into your own little, but there's a reaction. Now I'm saying the lack of reaction makes me think that there is no acknowledgement of the other person's humanity.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't need to accommodate you if I own you.
But even that is reactive. You know, it's a form of reaction. It's reacting to the object that the object doesn't warrant space. So it won't be given. So yes, it remains a reaction. And it's in a way like a tier of the ways that we see humans.
But I feel like you can almost... you can put somebody in a bus with a domestic worker and they'll still be more reactive than they would be in their home with their domestic worker. I swear to God, I don't know how we're going to test this. I promise you, I think most employers treat their domestic workers differently outside of their houses. If, and not if she's going shopping with you and she's still acting, when she's out of the role of domestic worker and you're in public space, I suspect that the relationship is slightly different, maybe even awkward.
But I guess it's, I mean, if you imagine the way that people treat their children at home versus treating their children in public, it's got to do, again, it's sort of instinctively with maybe the way that you want to be perceived in public versus the way you are okay to be in private. And we're seldom the same. So,
this is
yeah.
A true story. This is a true story. Association. I think we've touched on control.
Yes.
We've touched a lot on ownership, but what we haven't really touched on is access.
Yes. So you had said something about how, you know, isn't the domestic worker supposed to feel quite comfortable because she can access all the rooms and she can, you know, like, so isn't she supposed to feel just as comfortable, even more comfortable potentially? But it's always about the way that that access plays out, that inherently that access is given to her. She otherwise wouldn't be able to access that house, right? So it's not her access to give. It is her access to receive.
Okay.
And that's where it starts. And secondly, often the family has access to her space, even when she doesn't want them to.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've spoken to a couple of domestic workers who have said how they sometimes see that their room was, you know, inspected, things were moved around, no one told her, no one asked her. But, you know, usually the employers will feel like it is their right to, because it is on their property, it is their ownership. So that access is also quite skewed if someone can access your space, even though it is called your space.
Yeah.
So, yes, again, the perception of access is warped, because on the one hand, you have to be given access. It's not just yours. And on the other hand, access is taken.
Sure. There's a huge difference there, because I think a lot of people think access is access. Either you can occupy a space or you can't, but access can either be...
It needs to, there's
yours to give or yours to receive. I think that's very interesting.
And I think that's what a lot of historically white towns still feel like for a lot of black South Africans, is a space where they have to be given the opportunity to access it, or they have to be given the permission.
And yet I look at how upper middle class South Africans and expats will occupy a place like Vilakazi Street or
Absolutely.
Other parts of Soweto, for instance.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's where access is taken. And that's also been quite a huge problem with the architecture industry, when practitioners go into informal settlements and they do informal settlement community-based work. I don't know how many of them realize that, but again, access was never given. Access is often taken. There's the presumption that they can walk into those spaces and they can maybe just find a partner. Once they're there, they can find a partner that they can work with who's a community member. But mentally, psychologically, their access is actually not limited. It's maybe only limited to not knowing anyone. But it's not that they think, maybe there is a way that I might never be able to access this space. And it speaks to power. With, if you perceive that you can access a space, it's just a matter of semantics. I must just get to know someone, or I must just make an alliance with this. It speaks to how much power you feel like you inherently have.
What's interesting from an au pair point of view is the fact that I have often felt more comfortable occupying certain spaces in a house, right? So the living room, for instance, the dining room, I'm quite happy to eat my meals there. But I've never seen a domestic worker eat their meal at the dining room.
Why do you think you feel comfortable?
It's exactly what you're saying about, I think partly it's what you're saying about inherent power, maybe because I come from the same class, so I can identify with the space.
Mm.
I feel like I have territory, right?
Mm.
And so I feel like I can take access. Look at me using all your semantics. And therefore, the access is mine to take. I love it. I think that's partly to do with it. But then it's also definitely the way that I'm treated.
Mm. Yeah.
True. Right? I'm given more access.
Mm.
But even if I wasn't, like I said, a lot of these things are unsaid.
But imagine though, if you can distinguish that there's a distinction between the way that you're treated versus the domestic worker, then can you imagine how that perpetuates that spatial thinking and spatial relationship?
Mm.
You know, that you feel more and more comfortable with that as your space as well, and she might never.
And yet we're both employees.
Yeah. Yeah.
And none of this has ever been said expressly.
Yeah.
But it's understood. But no, you're the architect we need.
A star.
No, for real. And by we, I mean both MAID and South Africa. I think the fact that you're not South African gives you an advantage.
Yeah, it does help. It really does.
It means also that you just have so many nuances that exist in you, which actually allows you to understand nuance. It's fantastic. And we'll continue to have this conversation. I know what we want to do is to have it with domestic workers.
Definitely.
Both foreign nationals and South African domestic workers.
Yeah.
I think they have different experiences in terms of access, ownership, autonomy, control, association, and territory.
Can I very quickly speak to about autonomy?
Sure.
Okay, because just the idea that I had in mind regarding autonomy, right? Because spatial autonomy is really feeling the freedom to, right? To do whatever you desire within that space, whatever it is. And when you look, for instance, I mean, we spoke a bit about the domestic worker that speaks over the fence to her friend because there's a limit to where her friend can go, or some of the domestic workers have told us they have to get dropped off at the top of the street so that there isn't some strange car that stops in front of their house that might be suspicious and that might steal from them sometime. But all of those decisions that are made are not on the domestic worker's own terms, but they're on the employer's terms.
Mm.
So the ways that she determines how to act within space has everything to do with someone else. And that's when the falling apart of autonomy within space starts and continues. So ideally, she wouldn't like to be stopped at the beginning of the street and have to walk, but she has to make that decision not for herself, but for someone else's freedom.
And that's insane because that goes beyond the household, right?
Yeah.
That's on the street,
yeah,
which is a public space, but still her relationship with her employer and whatever that may be impacts the way that she feels in public space.
And that's how it gets out of a house or out of small scale into city scale. If you think, for instance, about where taxi ranks are, taxi ranks are not necessarily in a very prime area in Sandton.
Mm.
There's a reason for that. And it's, you know, I mean, besides territories that have been decided, but it's also not a subsidized industry. So it's not necessarily that they just have space to take, but they're also very strategic in terms of where their users go, but also in terms of what it means for that city.
Yeah,
you know, whether that city will be comfortable with
what
they will look like in that certain corner or things like that. So that works on a larger scale. So it really literally unfolds itself on varying scales.
There's all this latent bullshit, eh?
There is, huh?
That was like cast in stone or written. All these social codes that were written ages ago that we all subscribe to because we think they're normal.
Yeah.
You know, it's so many things are understood. It's understood. And it would have been cool to talk about, for instance, and we've had a show where we've spoken about how sometimes often domestic workers don't feel comfortable eating at restaurants.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
not only that, but I think the clientele in the restaurant would be a little bit uncomfortable if a domestic worker sat down. I know I wouldn't be uncomfortable, but I'd be confused. I'd be like curious, you know, it would be different because it's understood. Even I understand.
Mm.
I am coerced of the main sessions. I'm open-minded, you know. Mm. Our whole thing is about dismantling all of this crap.
Yeah.
But still, I would be confused, perplexed by something like that.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, I mean,
none of us are immune.
Yeah, I also fall prey to it all the time.
But I think that the shock has an effect on the subject. The subject being the person who, or the thing you're shocked about.
Mm.
And that can perpetuate it.
Mm.
You know what I mean? As opposed to it just being,
Yeah.
Neither here nor there.
But I mean, do you show active shock? Are you gasping?
No, not gasping, but there's definitely a vibe. Like, I'll definitely look.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Or maybe the way you phrase things.
Exactly.
Or, things like
or
that. Yes,
over
I
smile.
See. Yeah.
Even.
Yeah, true.
Right?
Very true.
And we know that when we overcompensate, sometimes it makes people uncomfortable too. So it's hard to win, huh?
Basically, huh?
But we are winning here with this here conversation. It was very cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
So stimulating.
Yeah, likewise.
As always.
Enjoyed. Very
really,
good questions.
I now have a deep love.
Aww.
Or at least an intrigue for all things architecture.
Thanks. I always hope that you'll become one.
Not a chance. But a critic I can be.
Go for it.
Of all
I
things.
I love it.
Okay, guys. And with that, thank you so much for joining us on the Mate Sessions with CliffCentral.com. To Lisa, Cindy, any last words?
Well, thank you. I just want to say thank you. It's not quite an easy topic to understand or talk about because I think so much are also things that we're uncovering, I think, as an architectural practice, certainly. But yeah, I just want to, I'm always very grateful for the platform, for the ability to start to discuss these things. And I mean, it's also getting to a stage where I'd really love for you, the public audience, to engage with us. And yeah, I mean, since this is the last show for the year, I just want to say have a very, very beautiful holiday season.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas.
And we look so,
Happy New Year.
And we look really forward to having more incredible discussions and just incredible things in general happen next year. But again, thank you so much. It's not easy topics to discuss, but I really hope that you can find some sort of comfortable space to throw out a lot of your personal experiences or ideas. We're always open to them. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. You are our peoples. And as much as you're faceless and nameless, know that you make a difference to us
and to
this endeavor. Yeah, man, you motivate us, you make us stronger, you make it worthwhile every single day. Okay, that's it from us. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and look after yourselves. Be safe on the roads, etc.
Please.
Yeah. Behave responsibly. We need you.
Yeah. All 12 of you. I'm joking.
No, really, they aren't 12. They're more than 12, I promise.
There's 13. Okay. I'm joking.
All right, guys. Lots of love. See you in 2017.
Peace. Twitter and stuff.
Oh, Twitter tools, Twitter.
Yeah. So Twitter, just go to @MadeProject, that's MAIDE Project, as well as our Facebook page, which is also Made Project, or you can type in the Made Sessions. We'd love to hear from you guys.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Cliff Central. The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.